The message of Isaiah is in one sense unapologetically stark. Someone described it thus: you have broken the covenant through idolatry, social injustice, and religious ritualism. So repent. No repentance, then judgment. Now, if that were the only message of Isaiah, we would be in desperate trouble. The people of God would be in desperate trouble. But Isaiah will continue, particularly in chapters 40 to 66, that is universally described as the book of consolation, with great encouragement for the people of God. And chapter 40 begins this book of encouragement. It is in this passage that I want us to focus, because in these chapters, particularly chapters 40 to 48, the prophet will bring uplifting themes like the greatness and the majesty of God, his undeserved affection and love for his people, and of course, the proclamation of redemption and restoration for the chosen people of God, John Oswald tells us. What I want to do is to discuss what Oswald calls the greatness and the majesty of God. And I want to describe that and seek to develop that under the rubric of divine incomparability. That God simply is incomparable. J. Gershon Machen says that in the King James Version, the rendering of Isaiah 40 is one of the noblest piece of prose in the entire English language. We love the King James Version. At least I still love it, even though I use the New King James. It is unbeatable in that respect. And this, whether rendered in the King James Version or in its original, is one of the marvelous passages of the scriptures, because the prophet is announcing comfort. Comfort through a coming redeemer, a coming deliverer. And you will note in chapter 40, verse 9, where he says to them, "Behold your God." This is a note of triumph. Your God is coming and he's going to redeem you. And really, the next major movement in the chapter, that is from verses 12 to 31, will go on to flesh out the character of this one whom he has said, "Behold your God." And in essence, we are going to suggest that the text teaches that this one to whom Isaiah points is our incomparable God. Now the passage, that is verses 12 to 31, is difficult to break down. You know it's difficult to break down when you have commentators can't agree. So I have taken the liberty of my own breakdown. It's not infallible by any means. I want to look at the passage in verses 12 to 14 as the first movement. And the second movement I want to consider verses 15 to 26. And then verses 27 to 31. And I'm going to seek to try to develop three aspects of divine incomparability. First of all, his prudence, that is his wisdom, his power, and his providence. What the text teaches us is that God is incomparable. And that, first of all, he is incomparable in his infinite prudence. In a seminal work in 1966 on the incomparability of God, Labuschagne, the scholar, a South African scholar, gave us a seminal work on this notion that God is incomparable. And what Labuschagne found broadly was that when you read the scriptures, it teaches you that God is incomparable by doing three things. First of all, it makes statements like there is none or nothing or no one like the Lord. So statements of negation. There is no one like the Lord. And then Labuschagne says that there are, secondly, the way in which it teaches that God is incomparable is by questions or by using rhetorical questions. Who is like the Lord? Over and over you will find these expressions. And the third major way is that it uses verbs to denote that God is incomparable, similar to who will you compare me to, this language of comparison. Now, all of these ways are in fact expressed in Isaiah 40 as he sets out the incomparability of God. But what Isaiah does is that he begins with rhetorical questions. Over and over in the text you find questions being asked. You cannot read in verses 12 to 14. There is a series of questions. You come to verse 18, questions again. Verse 21, verse 25, and verse 28. These are questions that are all aimed at the people of God. And one of the features you find in these questions is the question, who? Who? And you will find that in fact there are 20 times from verse chapters 50 to from this passage on to chapter 53 where this who is being introduced. In our text, we find it in verse 12, in verse 13, verse 14, 18, and 25. Who? And generally, when you find, at least in the first few verses, when the question is asked, who, the answer that is expected, because it is a rhetorical question, is the Lord alone. The Lord alone. But let's take a look at what he says in verses 12 to 14. Who has measured, he says, the waters in the hollow of his hand? Measured heaven with a span and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure? Weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has taught him? With whom did he take counsel, and who instructed him and taught him in the way of justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Here he begins by describing God and questions. Who has measured the waters? He describes God essentially as creator. And he describes God as a working with a little models. There are times, you know, when you go downtown and they have these open houses and they are going to build condos and they're going to develop a park, a part of Toronto, and they will show you a model to scale of the development. And you see these condominiums 50 stories up, but you could take them up with one little hand. And that's what he does here. He pictures God as a master craftsman who is working and constructing merely a model on his workbench, Webb tells us, who has measured the waters of the ocean in his palm, who has marked off the distance of the entire universe between the span of his thumb and little finger, who has enclosed the dust of the earth in a cup and weighed the mountains and the hills on his scale. These are questions that remind us of the questions that God asked of Job. But those questions were asked in a context of rebuke, because Job needed to remember that he was little and that God is infinite. But here these questions are asked, not for rebuke, but for comfort. These are not random questions. The first question in verse 12 points to God's cosmic sovereignty. But you need to understand that this statement about the God who created the universe is merely the opening salvo for a larger point that is being made in verses 13 and 14. That the God who created the universe, that he is incomparable in his wisdom, or as I've indicated, his prudence. In other words, what he argues in verse 12 and 13 and 14 is that if the Lord, in his infinite might and wisdom, could have created the world mysteriously and with effortless ease, then who could take his measure? He who takes the measurement of the creation, who can take his measure? Who can measure the depth and the breadth of the Spirit of God? Who can counsel him? Who can teach him about justice and the way of understanding? Who can enlighten this one who has worked so powerfully and mysteriously in this creation? Who can say to the Lord, "Now, Lord, I'm going to correct you because you're going about it the wrong way. Or, Lord, let me give you a piece of advice. Please take heed." The creature directing the creator? Surely it could not be so. And in an ancient Near Eastern context where there were pantheons of gods, all of them were viewed as together combining and in wisdom created the world. The prophet asked, who has measured the waters? Who has weighed this creation? And the answer must be none but Yahweh. You see, Labuschagne made an important point. He said rhetorical questions are vital. Because what they do is that they force you to form an answer in the mind. And when you form an answer in the mind, you begin to articulate the very point that the writer or the speaker wishes you to articulate. In other words, you join in with that person in affirming the reality, but you come to the conclusion on your own. And he's asking this question to proclaim that God is incomparable in his wisdom. It took great wisdom for God to create this massive world with its seas. It takes tremendous wisdom that only God possesses to create the hills and the mountains. And he's asking the question then, who can counsel him? Who can instruct him? You see, there were those who would perceive in their affliction, particularly in the exile, that God did not quite know what was happening. And they would question that perhaps God had lost the plot. You ever felt that God has lost the plot in your life? Things are chaotic. Well, in our parlance, Isaiah would tell us that the Lord does not depend upon consultants. He does not call board meetings. He does not conduct market surveys to find out the path of wisdom. Great is our Lord and mighty in power, his understanding is infinite. Psalm 147, verse 5. It is this God who could claim later, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." It is not, you see, that God is playing chess and the rest of us are playing checkers. It isn't that God is thinking two or three steps ahead of us. He's not in the game at all. He's nowhere to be found there. He's way above us, greater than us. In fact, he determines the beginning from the end. He has already known the end. He's not moving chess pieces trying to outwit us. He's the creator, the one who is infinite in power and infinite in wisdom. And And he needs no counsel, because there is none who can plumb the depth of the Spirit of God. God is incomparable, incomparable in his prudence, in his wisdom. And for that reason, we need not despair. I think that very often when we look at our lives, we cannot make sense. There are times we cannot make sense of the providence of God, of the work of God. And especially in a time like COVID, we may begin to think that things are awry, that there is no order, there is no balance, it is chaos only. And the writer would have us know that the one who measured out the heavens and weighed out the hills, this God is infinite in wisdom. And it means that we must never despair, because all of God's works are works conducted in wisdom. But the passage before us not only tells us that the Lord is incomparable in his infinite prudence, but that God is incomparable in his efficacious power. That I believe it's what is occurring in verses 15 to 26. And what the writer does is that he now looks at God's sovereignty, his reign and his rule and his power in relation to various entities. He begins with the nations in verses 15 to 17. In other words, the Lord who is able, who is capable of weighing the world, is no less capable of weighing the nations and the populace. This is what Kunz tells us. Look at what the prophet says. Behold, the nations are as a drop in a bucket, and are counted as a small dust of the scale. Look, he lifts up the isles as a very little thing, and Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor its beasts sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted by him less than nothing and worthless. We have mighty powers. For them, it was first the Assyrians. Later, it would be the Babylonians. Great military powers. Israel really had never been a great military power. Yes, they won victories, but they did so by the arm of God and by their strength. And they would quake as a little enclave of God's people, surrounded by great enemies. They would quake. But he compares the nations to the God who raised up creation, the God who created all. And he says that they are counted, the nations, that is, as nothing and worthless. He is not suggesting that people are worthless to God. That is, that human beings have no value. It's not the point. Rather, the point is that in comparison to God, in comparison to the wisdom, and now in comparison to the power of God, the nations of the earth are considered comparatively as nothing. Useless, futile. He compares them to the drop of water from a bucket pulled from the well. And that little drop that you don't miss, that does nothing, you lose nothing from the volume of water in that bucket. He compares them to the fine dust of the balance. You are weighing, for instance, flour on a scale, and there is residual dust, flour dust. It can't move the measure. It can't move the scale. So are the nations. That's their power. A drop of water. Fine dust on the balance. It is the incomparable power of God. He singles out these nations, and he singles out Lebanon, because he wants his people to know that however great the nations may project themselves to be, however great their kings may be, that there is a kingdom greater than theirs. It is the Lord, the sovereign power of heaven. He it says that Lebanon, as a representative of the nation, renowned for its cedar and its teeming with animals, even all of Lebanon did not have enough firewood for a sacrificial offering. Not all of the animals could be slaughtered and presented to God and therefore be considered adequate. They are inconsequential compared to God. They are as nothing to Him, as though they have no existence. They are infinitesimally small and insignificant in the presence of the august, the glorious, the majestic, the uplifted, the all-powerful God. All the nations of the earth combined are like a drop of a bucket in the fine dust of the balance. All of them, not one, all of them. You see, God is bigger than the nations. Well, you may ask, well, what about the idols of the nations? The ones that purportedly give victory to those who serve them. That's what he takes on now as he describes this incomparable power of God. He does so now in relation not to nations, but to their idols. And so you will find that a new strophe begins there in verse 18. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare to him? And I tell you that Labuschagne says there's another way where the verb is used, particularly compare, liken. In fact, there is a very interesting parallel in Psalm 89 verse 6 where these two terms are again used, again to emphasize the uniqueness of God. But he uses the term, the verb, Dama, or likened. Yadak, to compare. Really, he's asking, to whom then will you liken God? Or with what likeness will you compare him? Notice in verse 25, it's the same question. To whom then will you liken me? Or to whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One. But this term, to compare, to whom will you compare the Lord, refers to lining objects up in a row and comparing them. To whom then will you compare God? To whom will you put God in a row and compare him to others? You know, our children today have all kinds of gadgets. I don't understand how they play anymore. You know, we used to run around in the bushes and play, and we thought we were having fun. And we used to play with marbles. I don't know if our children even know what a marble looks like. And we got marbles for Christmas. We just thought we were blessed. And we would gather together, and our friends would come, and they would come with their different marbles, and we would have a big one over there and a green one there, and we'd put them in the row, and we would see which was the best of the marbles. We laid them out in a row. And this is what the prophet is saying. To whom can you compare the Lord? To whom can you put him in a row and compare him? Is there any equal? Is there anyone of the same stature or value of God? He's in a different category all by himself. You see, my dear friends, he wants them to know that God is incomparable in magnitude and in value. That there, he is not an analogous being similar with others of the same kind. No. He is incomparable. He is what we would say as incommensurable. There is, in other words, no common standard or measurement that can be applied to others, that can be applied to God. The rules that govern us cannot be applied to God. He's altogether different. To whom will you compare him? To whom will you liken God? And there the rhetorical question demands the answer. There is none to compare, to liken God. Well, what about idols? And really, Isaiah, well, he does it elsewhere, but here he pokes fun at idols. He says a craftsman makes them. The suggestion is that he makes them from inferior material, and then he covers them over with gold or silver. But what he does always, whether they are made of gold or silver, he makes sure that they have chains. You know why? That they may be fastened and held down. You know, they already made a mistake with Dagon by not fastening down. And if you're a good idolater, your God has to be secure, because he can fall and break his neck and break his hands. So you make sure your God is secure. And they fasten them. A poor man may not have gold. He can't buy a gold or commission a gold or silver idol. So he chooses a tree in the forest that will not rot easily. But he also makes it secure. But you see, God cannot be compared to idols. Tell me, you children, there are superheroes. I don't know if you children know any superheroes. I asked this afternoon a young lady, who was the greatest superhero today? And I thought she was going to say Superman, Batman. And she laughed. She says, of course, Wonder Woman. I've got to be politically correct. I lost the plot there. Tell me, children. Tell me, my friend. Do you think that Wonder Woman is greater than God? You wouldn't believe that Wonder Woman is greater than God. Incredible Hulk? Superman? Why is it that these superheroes are not greater than God? Well, it's for the very reason that the idols that people had were not greater. First of all, they were dead, and God is living. They were created in the imagination of someone, but God is the uncreated creator. He's the living God. And there is nothing in the whole panoply of idols that may be compared to him. No superhero. Muhammad Ali, when he was alive, took great pleasure in his powers. Some of them were imaginary. He would make comments. Apparently, he would tell you he was so fast, so swift, so quick, that when he gets into his room and wants to get to bed, and when he hits the light switch off, before the light goes out, he's in bed and under the covers. That's how fast he was. And he used to go around saying, I am the greatest. Well, we know that he was deluded. There is none to be compared to the Lord. There is none greater, more powerful in the entire universe than the God who took up the world in his hands and laid it out in his great might. No nation, no idol. Not even the entire creation is able to be compared to God. And so you find another series of rhetorical questions in verse 21, where the prophet asked, have you not known or have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Over and over, four times, have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you? Have you not understood from the foundation of the earth that it is he who sits upon the circle of the earth and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers? That God is sovereign in power and might, and he rules over the entire earth. He sits above the circle of the earth. Human beings, inhabitants of earth, are like grasshoppers. He spreads out the heavens like a tent. He is enthroned. And all are insignificant and minuscule in the presence of this Lord. We are as impressive as grasshoppers. You know, I think that I think this is a wonderful passage to read when our heads begin to get too large with pride. No greater than grasshoppers. Not only so, the princes and leaders of this creation are marked by brevity, so as all of us. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely have they taken root before the Lord blows upon them and they are gone. They are like stubble driven away by the wind. It's the brevity of humanity. Nothing in creation, not creation itself, not its kings and rulers, can be compared to the Lord. And again he thunders, to whom will you liken me? To whom shall I be equal? The answer is, there is none to be compared to you. None can be equated to you. You see, he's sovereign over creation. It is he says, lift up your eyes on high. Take note. It is he who created these things. He brings out the host by number. All of the stars of heaven. He created them and he knows their name individually. And it is by his great power and great strength that they are kept and preserved. He's incomparable then, not only in wisdom, but incomparable in his power. His inexhaustible knowledge of this creation means that he knows everything that is transpiring in his creation and transpiring in your life and in my life. Because you see, he's sovereign. And that means he can sustain them. If he sustains the entire host of heaven, he can sustain his people. And I would dare say he can sustain us even in COVID. But I want to hurry. Because not only do we see that God is incomparable in his wisdom or in his prudence, he's incomparable in his power, he's incomparable in his gracious providence. Really, all of these rhetorical questions have been moving to this conclusion that we find in verse 27. Why has the Lord been saying to them, to whom can you compare me? It is because in verse 27, the people of God in captivity would ask, that God would complain that God had abandoned them. And this is what the question brings out in verse 27. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God. He sees a day when his people, under persecution, will be saying that God has forgotten. God has passed over our case. God is not working on our behalf. Either he does not care, or he does not know, but he's not on the job. He's not on our side. And so the Lord has been saying, who can you compare to me? I am the great creator. I am the God of great wisdom, infinite wisdom. And he says, why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable, and he gives power to the weak. He says, I am the sovereign God, and I care, and I am engaged, and I am involved. I do not suffer ignorance. I am not unconcerned. Have you not heard? You have heard that I am the everlasting creator. And you see, he makes it clear that it is as the inexhaustible creator, the one who is tireless in strength, boundless in understanding, that he strengthens his people. He gives strength to the weary and to those who have no might. He increases strength. Isaiah will go on and say, even the robust, even the youthful, will faint and be weary, and young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. The language there is of exchange. They will exchange their strength. They will cast off weakness and they will put on the strength that God gives them. We saw that in the recently concluded Olympics. People who ran blistering pace in over 1500 meter race, when they get to the finishing line, they are young men, very fit, but they're on the ground, they're gasping for air, they can't even stand. And even young men and young women will deplete their store of energy. But those who wait upon the Lord, they shall renew. They shall exchange their strength. They will mount up with wings as eagles. They will run and not be weary. They will walk and not faint. Because God, who never tires, who never wearies, will carry them, will support them, will lift them up. That even if the outward man is perishing, the inward man will be strengthened, and he will give strength according to its day. My friends, I need to wrap this up, but let me just make a few concluding remarks about what we must do. You and I must know that God is incomparable. To whom will you liken him? That no one, but absolutely no one, is on the same level with God. That he is incomparable. We can't domesticate him. We ought not to relativize him. We mustn't think of God as merely greater and bigger than we are and smarter than we are. No, he's in a category all by himself. He's God. Infinite in power, infinite in wisdom. And it is this God who has revealed himself to be incomparable and has given us the incomparable gift of Jesus Christ. Paul could say, thanks be to God for his inexpressible, we may call it his incomparable gift. He has given us Jesus Christ. You see, he's incomparable in every sense, even in salvation through Jesus Christ. And you must know him as incomparable. You must receive his gift in Jesus Christ by faith that you may be saved. Do you know the incomparable God? But this reality that God is incomparable must encourage us. Many of us are tired and we are worn out. We would want to see the back of the virus last year. We're tired. We're tired. And like the exile community and subsequent generations of God's children, we may feel that God does not see or care about our plight. We might say, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God. But this was given to encourage us that despite all our trials, our deprivation, and our affliction, we may know that God is incomparable, that there is none like him. That he holds the waters of the world in the palm of his hands. He measures the heavens between his fingers. He pours the dust of the earth in a measuring cup and weighs the mountains on a scale. He knows the name of every star and he knows your name. He's above all kings and all humanity is like grasshopper compared to him. He's not only infinitely wise and infinitely powerful, but the reality is that the infinitely wise and the infinitely powerful God does not think that you are too small to ignore you. Even though he's so high and so lifted up, he does not think that you are unworthy of his attention. But he knows where you live. And he knows what you face. And he says, never forget that I am infinite in power and infinite in wisdom. But I'm infinite in my gracious providence. that I will see you through. And this is not a fool errand to believe, because there is none to be compared to him. Well, what must we do? We must know the incomparable God. We must draw encouragement that he is on our side. But we must trust in the Lord, that he sees the situation, the very heart of my situation and your situation. We must not be consumed by worry or trouble. One writer says that trust is never easy, but it is a key to unlocking the power of God. And so the writer says, those who wait upon the Lord. And batha doesn't mean just to sit there and biting our nails. It's really the term for hope. It is to look vibrantly. It is to look trustingly. It is to wait in expectation. And what do we do when we are in trouble? One writer tells us the first thing we are to do is stop looking at ourselves. Because the answer is not found in us. It is not found in politicians or in governments. So we stop looking at ourselves. What do you do when you wait on the Lord? You stop looking at yourself and you look away from self to God. But thirdly, you must expect good. That's what waiting means. To look, hoping that God will break the heavens and that God will come. Those who wait on the Lord will renew their strength. They will mount up. And even though the night may be dark, and even though the answer may not be found among men, it is found in God. So we wait. And in due time he will hear. In due time he will come. He will give the grace you need so you may run and not be weary. You may walk and not faint, but you must wait. And you must wait expectantly. Because there is none in the universe compared to God. SARS wasn't a problem for God, and COVID is not a problem for God. And when in his wise providence and counsel he has done his work, then he should be glorified. May you know, and may we all know, that you have the incomparable God on your side. You don't have to understand. I don't have to understand what he's doing. I only need to look to him by faith, waiting expectantly for his hand, for Jesus' sake. Amen.